And I would now like to introduce our first speaker, Tony Coleman, who's going to talk to us about an investor's perspective on climate change. Tony has a long and impressive CV, which I've left down there, but I know enough of it to know that he was the president of our institute in year 2001. Tony's been one of the actuaries who's been most prominent in raising public awareness and financial awareness of the consequences of climate change. He was a contributing author to, I think, the fourth report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in relation to insurance issues in his role as he then was the Chief Risk Officer of IAG. Today, he is the non-executive chairman of ARCX, which is an innovative carbon fund. And in the breaks, you can all find out exactly what that is from Tony. But Tony's expertise runs through the whole of the risk management areas that are affected by climate change. And indeed, in studying those things, I know he's gained a great personal insight into the science of climate as well as the economics. So please join me in welcoming Tony to the stand.
Well, thank you, Fred, for that kind introduction. I guess today's presentation could best be described as a little wide-ranging with my obvious background in risk, but I'm certainly trying to approach this from the point of view of an investor and an institutional investor in particular. So the sort of things that I'm going to try and cover are covered in that slide, and I'm going to try and pick the eyes out of a number of the things that have been talked about recently, including the Garner Review and the Green Paper, and try and give you a view of where we are in the journey towards, hopefully something happening in December 2009, which is the Copenhagen meeting of Kyoto, which is probably the next really major roadmap on the international roadmap and will certainly influence the government's thinking as it comes towards preparing its white paper and announcing the targets for 2020 in the carbon pollution reduction scheme that they've said they're going to announce before we actually get to Poznan, which of course is in December this year, Poznan being the forerunner to Kyoto. For those of you who are not familiar with why Kyoto is so important in 2009 in Copenhagen, essentially if an agreement is not reached in that meeting, there won't be enough time for all the countries involved to ratify before the first stage of the original Kyoto Agreement runs out in 2012. And that, of course, could be a rather chaotic outcome if we don't have some kind of global agreement on limiting emissions into the atmosphere by then. However, let's see how we go. That slide is really just to remind you of one simple thing. We're dealing with the climate, and the climate is a very complex system. And I'm not going to go into the science of climate change today, other than in one very small part in a moment. But I think the thing to remember is that we still actually don't know everything about it. And the other thing to remember is that we can bail the economy out, and indeed looks like we're doing that as we speak. The climate doesn't really respond to bailouts, but you can think of the long-term actions that we have to take perhaps as a bailout, but it's not in anything like as quick to react as an economy is, which is something we should all bear in mind as we think about this subject. Now, that slide there shows you the correlation between CO2 in the atmosphere over the last 400,000 years and the temperature. And indeed, there is a version of this slide now from ice cores in Antarctica that goes back 800,000 years, and I can tell you it looks exactly the same. It's just got another four sets almost duplicated to the left. As you can see, the correlation is pretty amazing. These two really do run together. So if any of you are still cynics out there about why this is important, I can just commend this slide to you. But what's really important about this slide is the shape. You'll notice that when both of them are rising, they rise very quickly. When they're falling, they fall slowly. And the reason for that is that there are quite a number of feedback effects which cause them to rise together quickly. And that is, of course, the situation we now find ourselves in the current climate. So bear that in mind. This climate is going to continue to react quickly upwards, and that is one of the reasons why this is actually an urgent problem. And one of the reasons why we have these feedbacks, one of the main ones, is the reflective power of the ice, which is sitting at the poles. basically when sunlight falls on the ice, 90% of it gets reflected back into the atmosphere, If it goes into water, about 90% of it stays in the water. So having ice effectively is very much a cooling mechanism, which pushes the temperature, or stops it going up so quickly. As the ice, of course, melts with warming, we get less and less ice, and therefore the warming accelerates. And if you look at that graph, which is at the top right, that is an illustration of what's actually going on with the Arctic ice at the moment. Now, many of you probably don't appreciate this, but the 2007 IPCC report had effectively a cut-off for scientific data at the end of 2004, because it takes about 2 years to actually collect all the data, discuss it, agree it with governments, and come up with policy recommendations for the report, which actually was issued in 2007. So the range of projections of the models for ice melt that you can see there out to the end of the century in that graph showed you the range that was based on the data that was known at the end of 2004 that the IPCC thought, with various available models, might indicate that the Arctic ice cap would probably melt towards the end of this century. The black line is the actual satellite data of what's actually happened. And as you can see, the black line has gone through a tipping point and has demonstrated, and in fairness to the IPCC, they did actually say in very clear terms, we do not actually accurately understand the process by which the ice melts, and particularly the ice that's on land. And therefore, this is a process where we don't actually have a lot of confidence in our models, and you can now see 3 years later why we might be saying that. It's gone right outside what any model predicted at all 3 years ago. Now, why is that important? Well, it doesn't really matter that much unless you're a polar bear in the Arctic ice, because that ice is floating. And therefore, when it melts, it doesn't really change the sea level. But, of course, right next door, we have the Greenland ice cap. The Greenland ice cap is very different. It sits on land. It's not floating. So when it disintegrates, and as it is starting to do, it will increase sea level quite dramatically. And it is not fanciful to suggest now that you could be looking at, instead of projections of up to maybe a metre of sea level rise that was in the 2007 IPCC report by the end of the century, it could be more like a metre per decade, because basically there's enough ice sitting on top of Greenland at the moment to raise sea levels by about 5 metres. If you also add the West Antarctic ice sheet, which is similarly vulnerable, there's another 5 metres there. So if all of that did happen to melt, or disintegrate actually is a more logical term. It doesn't actually need to melt. It can just disintegrate and be huge ice cubes in the sea for a while. We could be looking at maybe 10 metres of sea level rise. That is truly catastrophic if you think about what that does around the world. 1 metre of sea level rise will permanently displace over 140 million people. That's a pretty serious economic risk. There are other feedback loops which time doesn't really permit me to talk about, but they're mentioned on that slide there, and they are also quite powerful. This is why this is actually quite an issue. And indeed, the Garneau report did refer to this in some detail and pointed out that, in essence, the IPCC actually has a history of being quite conservative if you do a hindsight analysis of what they predicted in each of their four reports and then compare that to what actually happened with both temperature and sea level rise. And so in each case, generally speaking, what's actually happened has been towards the upper end of the range. On top of that, because of the very rapid economic growth we've had until rather recently, and maybe that problem won't be a problem for much longer, but certainly the Asian economic growth, and China and India in particular, economic growth and therefore additional CO2 going into the atmosphere has been accelerating, and indeed even over the last 2 years, while the IPCC were developing their report, more carbon has gone into the atmosphere. So what is Garneau saying about the way forward? Well, essentially, he's identified two targets, I guess, for the world to try to stabilise to. And I need to explain here, we're talking about CO2 equivalent targets, which means CO2 plus the other five major greenhouse gases rated according to their intensity as if they were CO2 in the atmosphere, as opposed to the actual CO2 concentration. The actual CO2 concentration in the atmosphere at the moment is about 380 parts per million, but the CO2 equivalent is, I think, now already in the order of 440. So Pagano has identified two targets, 550 parts per million of CO2 equivalent and 450 parts per million. And he's basically said we need to get at least to 550, almost as a minimum, in order to avoid dangerous levels of climate change, which is broadly defined as 2 degrees centigrade. And we need to try, and it would certainly be in Australia's benefit, if we can get the world to stabilise at 450. But he's basically taken the view that it might be very difficult to get the rest of the world to agree to limiting CO2 emissions to such an extent that we ever get back to 450. And so basically that is now the negotiating range that he believes is appropriate. He's also pointing out that it's very much in Australia's interest to deal with this issue, and I won't go through all of the reasons set out on this slide, but in essence, he believes, following his analysis, that there are very strong economic arguments why we should be dealing with this issue and dealing with it appropriately and with credibility, rather than perhaps designing a scheme which, shall we say, doesn't have the rigour that is required to actually reduce carbon emissions into the atmosphere. And his vision is broadly set out in that simple slide there, which is that somewhere down the track, and by this we mean probably sometime late this century, we need to get to a point where most countries in the world are emitting a similar level of CO2 per head of population. And we need to design a framework which allows each country to move from where they are now to get to that common level. That's obviously an almost ethical assumption about how we need to solve this problem, but it does obviously overcome the fairly obvious objection that we will get from people in China and India if we don't aim eventually to equalise carbon emissions into the atmosphere per head of population. What that means for Australia and the US, which have very high levels of CO2 per head, is that we basically have to start cutting and cutting pretty hard now, like 80% or more by the end of the century, or even earlier. For countries like China, there is actually scope to increase per head for a little while, but they will then also need to get to the point where they are limiting and falling, shown on that red line. A country like India is actually quite different. They are actually significantly lower than everybody, just about every other major country. They can afford to probably still increase CO2 emissions per head for some considerable time. And so basically this is a framework which does actually envisage how we could move the whole world by various succession of agreements to a conclusion. I won't talk much about this slide other than to point out that it does show that another country in our region which actually has a relatively high CO2 emission per head is Indonesia, and the main reason is they are heavily involved in deforestation. Interestingly, that actually presents an opportunity for Australia in that if we could wind up drawing them into an Australian emission trading scheme and create a regional trading scheme, perhaps including New Zealand and Papua New Guinea as well, there are estimates that have been put out there where at about $40 per tonne of CO2, it is conceivable that we could have... There are so much deforestation that could be reduced, if I can put it that way, it could actually almost put a price cap on Australian cost of carbon by effectively allowing us to use that as an abatement methodology. There are obviously a lot of issues around that, not the least of which to do with corruption and making sure you can enforce the agreements. But nevertheless, it's an interesting possibility. I'm not going to talk a lot about this slide because it's almost out of date already, even though it talks about things that were announced on the 5th of September. And maybe we can have a few questions later. But clearly there is now a range emerging around the work that Garnaut has done in which the government will have to make some decisions about what they will be prepared to do in setting a target for 2020 for the Australian Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme. It would be fair to say that the report that Garnaut put out on the 5th of September, which was not his final report, certainly did talk about two key figures, one at 5% reduction by 2020 and the other at 25% reduction by 2020 in absolute terms. And we won't get into the per capita part of it just now, but the per capita targets are significantly higher than that, because Australia's population is continuing to grow, so that over the period from 2000 to 2020, obviously that does make quite a difference, which is a key difference, by the way, compared to the position in Europe, where the population isn't growing so rapidly. However, essentially, what is favoured by Garnaut, and I think the government is likely to accept, is a position not dissimilar to the one that has been adopted by the European Union, where essentially you set one target that you're prepared to meet no matter what, and a second target that you're prepared to meet provided everybody else agrees to an aggressive target as well, in other words, a higher target. And so that is essentially the range we are now talking about. And in the case of the European Union, their targets are 20% by 2020 is what they're going to do. They will commit to 30% provided other major developed countries, particularly the US, join them. I won't go into the great detail of how a cap-and-trade scheme works, but other than to just give you this very simple example to make sure that everybody understands the concept, just imagine you have a very simple economy with only 120 tonnes of CO2 per annum and being emitted, and two manufacturers each responsible for half of that. The government's now decided that's too much and we're only going to have 100. In this situation, if manufacturer A can abate their CO2 at $10 per tonne cost and manufacturer B can only do it at $20 per tonne, if we have no trading, clearly what has to happen is that $300 has to be spent to get each of the manufacturers to reduce by 10, and that would be the cost to the economy. However, with trading, it's fairly obvious that what will start to happen is that there will be trading between manufacturer A and manufacturer B, and the price will settle at that trading somewhere between $10 and $20, and the optimum outcome for the economy is for manufacturer A to actually spend $10 a tonne and reduce by 20, thereby the whole economy is only the cost to do the abatement would only be $200, and that flexibility is introduced by the trading. That's why an emission trading scheme basically works in simple terms. Now, why is it different to a carbon tax, which some people favour? It's relatively straightforward economics. Essentially, in a cap-and-trade scheme, what you're doing is limiting the supply of CO2 which you're allowing to go into the atmosphere, and you're then allowing the market to set the price for the CO2. So in the carbon tax, it's basically the other way around. Use the tax to set a price on the price to emit carbon, and then you let the economy figure out how much carbon it will emit at whatever price that you have set by virtue of the tax that you have put on it. Now, from an environmental point of view, the environmentalists tend not to like that option much because it doesn't give them any certainty as to how much carbon will actually be emitted from time to time. And so that is one of the reasons why cap-and-trade schemes tend to be more popular. But nevertheless, carbon taxes certainly are advocated by some people, particularly in the early stages of getting a scheme up, and I think it's fair to say that some countries will probably adopt carbon taxes rather than emission trading schemes as time goes forward, simply because emission trading schemes are actually pretty complex things to set up and run and get right, as the European Union experience has shown us. I have a few comments here about the basics of the Green Paper, which the government put out in July. Given that I think this has had a fair bit of coverage already, and I suspect Blair might also cover it a little later today, I'm just going to go over some of this at a fairly high pace. The main thing to bear in mind here is that it is a scheme which has quite wide sectoral coverage quite quickly compared to other schemes that have been put in place around the world. Basically, the only major sector that's not in the scheme straight away is agriculture, and the plan is to bring that into the scheme by about 2013. But certainly all the other major sources of emissions will be covered by the scheme, so certainly power generation, transport, forestry is an opt-in, mainly because it's likely to generate credits, and fugitive emissions will be caught as well. That's a little unlike for the EU, where the EU has progressed in stages, but, for example, aviation is only just being captured by the EU in its next stage, whereas we're basically going to jump straight in with that. I think much of the framework that's set out in the Green Paper has been relatively non-controversial. What has been controversial has been the proposals around who will get what compensation and how that compensation might be calculated. The paper basically set out a proposal where if you're deemed to be an emission-intensive and trade-exposed industry, then you may be eligible for compensation based on the emission intensity per dollar of revenue in your organisation, and basically set two thresholds which were quite hard, and a bit like cliff edges, where if you're on that side of the threshold, you've got compensation at a given level, and if you weren't, then you got basically nothing. So there wasn't any gradation to it. There's been quite a lot of discussion about whether that's the appropriate way forward or whether it should be based on value add or some other criteria to give compensation, and I think that's been by far the most controversial area, and it'll be very interesting to see where the government lands when it comes out with its white paper, basically setting out its policy. The reason why those two thresholds were set and why they're interesting is set out in that slide there, which comes straight out of the green paper. And you can actually see on that slide the emission intensity per dollar of revenue or various types of economic activity. And you can see that, in particular, cement and steel are right up there as, shall we say, CO2-challenged industries. Interestingly, so are many of the agriculture industries, but, of course, they're not quite so concerned because they're not going to get wrapped in for another 7 years or so. The industries, though, that pass that $2,000 per tonne of revenue are the ones that basically fall easily into there. And, of course, the other industry that's particularly there is aluminium, which probably is the most emission-intensive industry of all. And we'll come back to talk a little bit at the end of the talk a little bit about particular companies on the ASX that might have particular issues and how that might unfold. I'm sure some of the other speakers later today will be talking about that as well, seeing Andrew Gray sitting over here. I thought I'd talk very briefly about carbon offsets, just to make sure people understand there are two fundamental types that we're talking about here. There is the compliance market, which, of course, is largely what the Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme is setting out to focus on. There is also a voluntary market, and the challenges are there predominantly surround the different qualities of permits that are available, and in particular whether the underlying reduction really was a reduction that would have happened in the absence of having the permits available, an issue known as additionality. I won't go into the detail of that there, but just bear in mind that what tends to happen over time, at least there seems to be a suggestion that this is the case, as markets develop compulsory compliance mechanisms of carbon trading, the voluntary markets tend to wither a little bit but not necessarily die. They've tended to find there are niches sometimes around the edges of the compliance markets. But my view is that as the compliance markets develop and grow and extend in their coverage, the voluntary markets will obviously find themselves being more and more squeezed. I won't go into the great details, time doesn't permit, but just to be aware that the under Kyoto Protocol, there are two main ways in which certified emission reductions can be generated under what's known as the Clean Development Mechanism and also under joint implementation projects. JI is actually the poor cousin here. There are very few JI projects that actually be done. These are projects between developed countries or where one country invests in another developed country. The CDM is where a developed country essentially invests in a lesser developed country, and the major beneficiaries of the CDM have been China and India. Really, the point of that slide is just to make it clear that there are a lot of other countries out there developing emission trading schemes now. We're by no means on our own, and we're by no means a leader in this space. The EU have been doing this for quite some time, with, I guess, some degrees of limited success, but increasingly more successful. And you can see the other countries there that are working on it. Interestingly, the first auction of CO2 credits in the US occurred only last week under the one mentioned at the bottom there, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative of the Northeast States. $3 US, I think it was, for the initial CO2 credits under that scheme. I think it'd be fair to say that a suggestion from that might be that the scheme is a little bit over-allocated, but we will see how that develops going forward. And we can come back later and talk a little bit about the politics of this issue in the US if you wish. I was actually in the US for the last 3 weeks and got some quite interesting insights as to how that might interact with the current meltdown on financial markets. I won't talk a lot about that either because I know I've got to keep moving on time. One of the other issues here, which is actually really important, is not to just be relying on the emission trading scheme or the carbon pollution reduction scheme, as we're calling it in Australia, to be the sole policy measure to deal with this problem. It's obviously probably the most important measure, but if we just relied on that, we would be putting all of our eggs in one basket, and probably there would be a lot of other things that can be done or need to be done, which actually won't happen unless we take specific complementary measures. This has been the subject of a study by Mr. Wilkins, which is still, I think, not entirely public in the conclusions he's coming to. But that particular slide is a slide that comes from a study by McKinsey's, which has been replicated in many countries around the world. This is the slide for Australia. What it really shows and why it's important is that there are a lot of very low-cost, indeed negative-cost opportunities, which are the ones shown in that circle on the left-hand part of the slide, to reduce carbon emissions, which tend not to happen sometimes, and many of them are actually in the property industry, and tend not to happen because of a misalignment of incentives between tenants and landlords. So there is actually a need to have regulations sometimes, I think, in place, which will ensure that all of those opportunities are captured in order to make sure that we can actually get emissions down in the lowest cost possible way. There are several other messages that are actually quite interesting in that slide about what the long-term cost of the carbon CO2 might be. But it does also basically, the message basically is, as you can see there, in order to reduce emissions by orders of 20 to 30% by 2020, you can see that there actually are quite a lot of options in Australia and that the cost curve is not rising strongly, it has a long, flat trajectory to it in real terms, at least according to McKinsey's. That's actually quite an optimistic way of looking at, well, I'm not saying McKinsey's is optimistic, but it actually is saying that this the fact of dealing with this problem may not be as costly as some people suggest at the present time. The other major complementary measure, of course, is the mandatory renewable energy target, which has been around under the Howard government since 2001. But the Rudd government, as many of you be aware, have materially increased the target now to generate 20% of our energy, 20% of our electricity from renewable sources by 2020. The interaction between the MRET and the emission trading scheme is going to be one of the really interesting things to watch, and whether or not that actually means that we might wind up with a slightly higher overall cost of electricity than we might otherwise have done if we just had the emission trading scheme remains to be seen. I think it's fair to say that the plan is that MRET would actually be phased out after about 2020 once the emission trading scheme itself is well and truly established. So you can think of these, in I think the government's mind anyway, as two complementary measures such that if one of them essentially doesn't succeed, the other one might well capture some of the issues that need to be dealt with. However, it does raise some rather interesting issues, and a paper that was published, I think, about 3 months ago now by the Electricity Supply Association of Australia explored some of those based on some modelling work that I think OCL Tasman did. And this was a particularly interesting paper, particularly from an investment point of view, about some of the issues that it identified, not the least of which was that it basically came to the view that the MRET and the emission trading scheme looked like they were going to be able to broadly live in coexistence without generating major discrepancies in the marketplace, subject to some obviously reasonably important assumptions about the way in which coal-fired power stations in particular were phased out of the market and replaced in an organised way by renewable energy power supply. But it did actually also identify that what we essentially are facing by 2020 is having to do a very substantial replacement of what a large proportion of the existing power supply capacity of Australia. And that alone is a pretty massive construction and investment task. You know, not all that, only 12 years to do it if we were to meet these targets. Very roughly speaking, allowing for the growth that we need to have in order to meet, you know, the economic projections that we have, About a third of our current generation capacity will need to be effectively replaced during that period. That represents, including the investment required in new elements of grid that would have to be built to supply some of that renewable power, an investment in the order of $40 billion needing to be made. That's no small investment in a country this size, and obviously is a huge investment opportunity for those who are involved in the building of such power supply facilities. These are basically going to be wind, solar, and in various forms, and probably geothermal power supply. I thought I'd just put that slide up for a moment. For those of you who are sitting as business people or people investing in businesses, to have as a framework for thinking about how climate change will actually impact your business. I think it's fair to say a lot of people haven't really thought this through too well yet, and a lot of people are taking the fairly simplistic approach of saying, well, if I now actually know what my carbon footprint is and how much I'm emitting, and by the way, that's not necessarily an easy thing to establish, but even assuming we've got that, if I work that out, I apply $20 a tonne to that, well, that's sort of like what my liability would be, and that's pretty much it. Unfortunately, there are a lot of businesses where there are a lot of other effects that will impact the business in the supply chain or in the customers, which go beyond just thinking about your own specific emissions, be they your direct emissions or your indirect emissions. So I would encourage you all, when you're thinking about this with your businesses, think about it in a framework that involves all of the aspects of your business, because you'll probably find all sorts of things when you start to think about it that impact that. Classic example would be, of course, the business I was quite associated with until recently, the insurance business, where its own CO2 emissions are actually immaterial in the scheme of things in terms of the profitability of the organisations. But, of course, insurers are probably amongst the most vulnerable in some ways to the impacts of weather-related events on climate change, which can have a very material impact on their business. Emissions trading will clearly impact the steel and cement industries, which by definition will impact directly on the building industries. Cement, for those of you who don't know, is a very emission-intensive process, although interestingly, when I was in the States, I'm now told that there is some emerging technology which might dramatically reduce the CO2 profile, emission profile of cement manufacture. So it would be very interesting to see how that begins to develop around the world. That, of course, will mean all sorts of searches in buildings for alternative materials and more efficient ways of doing things. And, of course, you know, ways in which buildings are insulated and lit and how water is supplied to them can also have material impacts in all of these areas. I was going to talk a little bit about hazards, but I think time is going to get past me. I suppose the thing I just wanted to talk very briefly about is, first of all, just those two photos I think are quite revealing. That's the Gold Coast, 1966 and now, roughly. You can see that basically, depending on what's there, you can have a very different exposure to risk of what's actually potentially vulnerable over relatively short periods of time when you're talking about climate change. Cyclones clearly could conceivably reach the Gold Coast. As shown there, that's actually the map of a real cyclone back in 1967. And indeed, all of the climate modelling shows that it is much more likely that those sort of cyclones will move further south as climate change progresses. And when you consider that very large parts of the Gold Coast are built certainly in the order of a quarter to a half of a metre above high sea level, and you think about the way cyclones work, cyclones are basically low-pressure systems, so when they're sitting over the sea simply rises underneath them in order to equalise the pressure. It's really quite simple physics. That typical storm surge under a cyclone is generally 2 to 3 metres. That's before we worry about wind waves on top. That's just the storm surge, pure pressure effect. So when the cyclone crosses the coast, the sea will basically be a couple of metres higher to begin with. Then, of course, typical cyclone, very high winds, that will generally add another 3 metres at least of wind waves. So it's not inconceivable you get 5 metre sea level increase, you know, at the top of the waves as a cyclone crosses the coast. which of course is one of the reasons why Katrina and Ike and others have been so damaging in the US. Of course, the Gold Coast, the problem is that a lot of it's within half a metre of high tide level. It's a bit of an accident waiting to happen. The other problem with that, of course, is that a lot of the value of that property, particularly if you're an investor, is in the land, in the waterfront land, not in the building so much. And the building will often be insured anyway. The land value will not. So if we get into a situation where with sea level rising, and particularly you'll recall what I said earlier about ice and the poles, and we get more severe weather events, it's entirely possible that land near the water will simply not be usable anymore. It may well be inundated, or the government or the local council might simply say it's not safe to use anymore. So people who own that land will simply lose the value of it entirely. If you happen to be an investor in that land, or an infrastructure investor, if the land happens to be an airport or a port, that's a pretty serious issue. And I don't think many of investors have really started thinking about that yet, but I'd suggest that they should be. That's a map of showing you the same sort of problem in Melbourne, in St Kilda. It's fairly low-lying. The blue is basically the area that's vulnerable. Similar, if you don't think it's a problem in the Gold Coast only, that's Manly in Sydney. It has a similar problem as well. Manly Golf Club in particular is very low-lying, and some of the areas around it. And that slide really just sets out some of the other both risks and opportunities that will befall certain industries as a result of some of these trends, which unfortunately time doesn't really allow me to go into in great detail. So, from all of that, where might some of the investment winners and losers in all of this be? Well, I guess the first thing I should say is, based on the events of the last month in investment markets, it'd be a fairly brave person to stand up here and try to predict too many winners or losers on a long-term basis, let alone even tomorrow. However, having said that, one of the interesting correlations here is the incidence of what many people are calling peak oil, which is the graph on the left, depending on who you believe, when current oil production as we know it may tend to start to go down and have to be replaced by other forms of fossil fuel energy, versus how the world might ultimately get its act together in terms of addressing greenhouse gas emissions. The two of them are obviously very important in terms of the correlation between them, and yet I think often are looked at as two different issues or two different problems. So it's something to watch going forward. That graph there basically just shows you a comparison of what's happened to the oil price, what's happened to the New Energy Index, which is a global index of about 90-odd companies in 20 countries, which is essentially like a clean tech index, going back over the last 2 or 3 years, or since December 2005, and showing you that compared to the MSCI as well. The interesting thing about that is that the Cleantech Index has actually substantially outperformed over that period, which is up until the end of June, the standard MSCI. But, of course, in Australia, that interestingly, that's not the case. And indeed, in the month of September, the NEX Index was underperforming the MSCI. However, it is possible to look at how at least emissions are likely, or the cost of a carbon liability, if you like, is likely to impact different companies. And on this slide, we've kept it to the ASX. And first thing I should say here, there, if you look at the Carbon Disclosure Report, for which was launched on Monday, there are three companies that stand out as having a very large potential liability under the Australian Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme. All of them have, if you value their carbon liability at $20 a tonne, more than 20% of their earnings before tax, interest and depreciation and amortisation are absorbed by their carbon liability. And those are Lumina, BlueScope Steel and OneSteel. You then have a group of about another eight or nine companies where they fall in the band of between about 5 and 10% of their earnings before interest and tax, depreciation, amortisation, taken up by their carbon liability. This is before we know anything about whether or not they get compensation, I should add. And Those companies include companies like Qantas, Boral, I think Contact Energy's in there, one or two others, which I suspect Andrew might talk to you about more. The difference between that and this slide, which shows you a very similar measure, is that on this slide, the analyst concerned, which was Elaine Pryor at Citibank, has tried to make some estimates of what would happen to these companies' earnings on the ASX if they qualified for the compensation which the Australian government is talking about giving. And you'll see there that the percentages of their earnings, and some of the companies that I've just mentioned are mentioned again on this graph, are significantly lower. We're now talking in terms of changes, you know, ballpark less than 5% by the time we factor in what may or may not be different versions of compensation that they get. So the message is, I think, that for large listed companies at least, by the time we factor in the compensation, some of the impacts may not be quite so dramatic as some of them might be expecting, despite the fact that quite a lot of them are making quite a lot of noise, as you might expect, about the fact that they might be losers in this scheme and are therefore actively trying to prevent that. And, of course, that's where a great deal of the media has been focused. And that's probably the one other comment I would like to make. We shouldn't lose sight of the opportunities that this creates for business as well and for investors, this whole scheme, and the changes that we're having to adopt in order to go through a change to abate carbon emissions from our activities. Now, just to demonstrate as well that you actually can also make some money in this, this is just a graph showing you the performance up to the end of August for the fund that I'm actually the chairman of. And you can see there that up until the end of August, admittedly this is only 8 months of trading because they only started trading in January, their performance investing in essentially companies which in the long run will either benefit as a result of energy efficiency or decarbonisation of the economy, they're about, at that stage, they were almost 25% ahead, which is a fairly large outperformance of either the MSCI or the ASX 200. Even after September, that number is still either 16 or 18%, depending on whether you're talking about the ASX or the MSCI 200. So although September was a pretty traumatic month, in a slightly longer-term sense, it is clearly possible to generate some serious outperformance if you invest in and you know what you're doing in this area. And that has been fully invested right through that period in a global equities portfolio, so it's not like they set it out with some cash along the way. So that's essentially the conclusion of the remarks I wanted to make. I'm in the chairman's hands as to whether we have time for one or two questions.
John Erickson. Tony, when you were mentioning forms of renewable energy, you mentioned geothermal and solar and wind. You didn't mention nuclear. Now, I know the Western Australian government has changed its stance, but in a global context, nuclear energy is accepted by some countries and not by others. Would you care to comment further, please?
Sure. I think, in summary, if the country already has some nuclear power, they're prepared to continue contemplating having more of it, or at least not shutting down some of the old nuclear power plants. A country like Australia, which at the moment has pretty much no nuclear power other than Lucas Heights, I think there's still pretty strong political pressure, you know, against it, for mainly around reasons around disposal of the waste and possible nuclear proliferation. I don't think nuclear power is necessarily a wonderful solution anyway, for a number of reasons. What a lot of people don't appreciate with nuclear is that, of course, building the plants takes a long time, because of all sorts of regulatory requirements. And in addition, once you build it, you invariably use a hell of a lot of concrete because you're trying to, and a bit of steel, you're obviously trying to prevent things leaking out of the plant, generally speaking. As we've just talked about, concrete is an incredibly emission-intensive product. So the problem you wind up with when you do a typical nuclear power plant is that if you look at it on a life cycle basis, it takes about 10 to 15 years of operation at least for the nuclear power plant not emitting, you know, to get back to the point where you've sort of clawed back the emissions created by its construction, so that if it takes you, say, 5 to 10 years to get approvals to build it, another 5 or 10 years to build it, and then another 10 to 15 years to actually get back to where you would have been, you're looking at 20 to 30 years at least before you're actually ahead on emissions. We don't have 20 to 30 years to solve this problem. So that's why nuclear isn't really a great solution, and it's not all that cost efficient. Well, it's not dramatically lower cost than where solar and wind in particular are at the moment, and where geothermal appears to have the potential to get to. A lot of people don't realise, but solar is rapidly coming down the cost curve now, and particularly thermal solar or thermal concentration solar as opposed to photovoltaic. There are three major different types of solar now, by the way. There's traditional photovoltaic, there's thin film photovoltaic, which is quite different in its characteristics, cost characteristics, and then there's thermal, which is completely different again. Thermal would appear to be actually becoming the one that could well be very cheap, provided we can get relatively cheap grids to move it from where it's generated in wide open spaces to where it's needed, you know, in cities.
Thank you, Tony. Pablo from Perpetual, I'm just wondering, you mentioned earlier that you had just been in the US and you had some insights as to how this will, like the current debate on, particularly the presidential election, the credit crisis and climate change will interact. Can you comment on that a little bit, please?
Sure. Well, the first thing to say is that the official position of the two candidates is that they will both introduce an emission trading scheme for the US as a whole. I think the difference between them is probably the priority they will give to that relative to other things. Now, and I think it's fair to say the view seems to be that Obama would probably have a higher priority to it than McCain at the present time, particularly when you understand that, you know, the Republican election cries, you know, drill, baby, drill, meaning drill more oil, particularly around, in and around the coastal areas of the US and including Alaska, which, by the way, given the amount of reserves they might find, will make no difference to the problem at all, but that's virtually no difference. Issue really being discussed in the US at the moment is whether or not we need to solve, you know, fixing the economy and the global meltdown first and then come back to climate change later. And there's two schools of thought, obviously, fix the economy first and fix our energy security problems first and then worry about the climate second is one school. The other school basically says, and this is being pushed very hard by Al Gore in particular, and bear in mind, Al Gore, of course, comes from the Democratic Party and is probably able to have some influence with Obama should he be elected. Al Gore's view of it is it's called the Green Jobs Campaign, and basically they're going to try... He believes it's possible to fix the energy security problem, the climate problem, and the cost of energy problem with a program which essentially sees America reinvesting in renewable energy in a way that actually generates quite a lot of jobs. And he's basically talking about wind power, solar power, particularly solar thermal power, and grids, intelligent grids that allow them to transmit power cheaply and bring power to where it's needed, you know, according to the peak of power demands. Because the way wind and solar work, you know, they're not all on all the time as a thermal fossil fuel generator generally is, so you need a more intelligent grid to be able to manage the transmission of the power around in order to ensure that you've got the power where you need it. That means you need to build new grids. All of that, the theory is, of course, if you invest, you know, via effectively a Keynesian process to pump the economy up with that kind of investment, solves your renewable energy problem and solves your economic problem all at once. And by the way, it also solves their oil import problem. The other point to bear in mind, $700 million being used to bail out, in inverted commas, the US finance industry at the moment, $700 billion is also happens to be the amount of money the US spends every year importing oil. When you sort of focus on that as a cost equation, you suddenly realise that maybe they do have to get serious about renewables.
One further question, please. I think we need to move to the next speaker, but remember that Tony will be available in the panel at 4:15 this afternoon.
It's Helen from Lachlan Partners, and this may be covered a bit later on in the day, but everything about investment opportunities always seems to be on the macro level regarding infrastructure. Do you see any or have you come across much development more on the micro level in regard to changing and development of renewables in that area?
You mean individual companies or...?
Oh, I mean rather than major infrastructures and grids, rather things happening in people's homes on a massive scale.
There's a whole area around what could be broadly termed energy efficiency and the need to install smart meters in homes, and I'm sure all of that will come. There's a huge community education campaign that I think in many ways has already started about how we can use energy more effectively and efficiently. It's really quite interesting for those of you familiar with the California experience. The actual energy efficiency measures that California adopted, I think, nearly 5 or 6 years ago now, have been very effective, and the actual energy per head of population being used in California today is lower than it was, I think certainly 6 or 7 years ago. I can't remember the exact time period. But they have been very successful with a series of moves that they have made to simply make use of energy much more efficient. And, of course, that's also part of the equation. And indeed, investing in companies that have, provide the services and products that allow that to happen is another, way of taking advantage of this trend.
I think we better close that discussion now, and I hope you'll all join with me in thanking Tony for what has been a very comprehensive view of the science and the impact on our economy. Thanks.